This is Full-Time Catholic Radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the Internet at WDEO.net.
I have a pro-life hero on the phone with me today, Robert G. Marshall. He goes by Bob. Sometimes he goes by Delegate Marshall. Has written a new book that we're going to talk about. But before we get to that, I just want to say that if you're in Virginia, you know him well. He was a member of the Virginia House of Delegates from 1992 to 2018. He won 13 general elections and represented the 13th district for 26 years. And during that time, he was a pro-life warrior. He authored 65 laws, bills, and budget amendments, included those who protected privacy, defunded Planned Parenthood, yay, protected jurors from intimidation by gangs, and amended Virginia's Constitution to define traditional marriage, another yay, and ban partial birth abortion, triple yay. So, Bob Marshall, you're very, very welcome to Church and Culture.
Neil, thank you very much for having me on.
And you have a new book from Tan, and Tan's really been putting out some great books lately, and yours is entitled Reclaiming the Republic. It's an A to Z civics for Christians and conservatives. My good friend Bob Riley, who's been on this show many, many times, says about your book, no one knows the intersection of theory and practice better than Bob Marshall. Reclaiming the Republic speaks in the language of moral principle and political street smarts on behalf of the highest things. And having read the book, Bob, I agree with our friend Bob Riley. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Now, is this something, you say in the introduction that this was spurred by your experience in the 2017 legislative election. Could you tell our listeners about that?
Well, the district I represented had been won by Obama twice, although I won it myself. But in 2017, I saw a tidal wave coming that I had never seen before. My opponent raised about almost $1 million, putting me in the crosshairs of the LGBT interest groups nationwide. He got about $180,000 from one donor in Milwaukee, and in 2015, I won the election by spending $115,000. So he was able to organize a lot of people. A lot of homosexuals came out, and they weren't picketing my house for passing the constitutional amendment. They decided to do something which ended up being more productive in walking precincts, and so that's what they did. Significantly outspent me, and won. Afternoon, my wife and I were walking in a precinct, which Democrats win, but I was, trying to cut the margin. We saw six Planned Parenthood workers. They had shirts on and everything. Within about an hour and 10 minutes, I thought to myself, if they're doing this in all the precincts, that's about 105 people walking today. So they did the organizing, and they got the prize. So I'm thinking,
so you're an opponent.
I am not selected.
Yeah. Tell our listeners about your opponent.
Is a guy who thinks he's a woman. And, that used to be transvestites or cross-dressers or whatever. I'll pray for my opponent. But boy, he's got some notions that are a strict variance, certainly with both common sense, reality, and the Catholic teaching, which he claims to have been brought up in. He quotes St. Francis de Sales, but he only quotes half of the sentence. He forgets the other part, which talks about loyalty to the real truths of the Catholic faith and morality, but he won, by talking about an issue over which I had no control, but the public didn't know that. In Virginia, local government is responsible for designating what roads get built, for the most part, other than interstates. And I had been trying to prod my local people into doing something. Didn't work, and so he won. But that's fine. That's passed. What I don't want deal is for this to be replicated across the United States, and they give every indication that the race against me was a kind of a test case to see what they could do. So they got people out to vote who don't normally vote or vote once every 4 years. And if our side doesn't do this and do it more proficiently than the other side, we're in big trouble, because the LGBTQXYZ people have absolutely no tolerance for public dissent or difference with their view of things. And as is the case with that baker from Colorado, and although he got off the hook temporarily, it was like a football team having 12 men on the field. It was a technical circumstance that got him from under the jaws of being put out of business. But being put out of business is precisely what the LGBT people want to do to Christians. And that's not a joke. That's not hyperbole. That's simply a fact. There are a number of cases around the United States in which professionals who offer services are being challenged to participate in celebrations of sodomy marriage, which I think is ridiculous. It's not a marriage at all, but that's what it, you know, that's what we're dealing with. And
yeah,
they don't want to do it. Yeah.
You weren't the only guy to lose, though.
Oh, no. No.
There were,
no.
Were there 15 in all of GOP 15 delegates?
15 other Republicans lost. That's correct. But in other words, mine was the prototype district. And I could, you know, find you the, you know, sources and the
oh, I believe you. I mean, you, yeah. You are the perfect target for this. I mean, you know, 26 years as a pro-life Catholic, standing
right.
Tall, you know, not compromising. I mean, everybody around here knows who you are and respects that greatly. And we, needless to say, we were quite shocked when this happened. And I think you described it very well as a out-of-state hit job.
Well, it certainly was, because a lot of the people who were walking precincts didn't live here. I mean, it's their prerogative to do this, but they just organized that way and were able to do it. And most of the money came from out-of-state in my circumstances, which is all legal. So I can't really complain about them doing things that are legal. And it was certainly shrewd. But, again, this is a model for the rest of the country. And if the Christians don't start to pay attention to Caesar's world, which Christ tells us to do, he said, render to Caesar what is Caesar and to God the things that are God's. Well, if you don't know who Caesar is, what Caesar's powers are, how Caesar operates, or what Caesar is requesting of you, and is it within Caesar's legitimate power to do that, how are you being faithful to Christ's command? I don't think you can be faithful if you just want to ignore this.
Well, Bob, let me put a question to you about that. As you well know, you know, the history of Christian involvement in American politics, or, you know, really changed radically beginning with the Jimmy Carter administration, which you mentioned, by the way, in your book. And, you know, since then we've had the growth of very large and supposedly very influential Christian, mostly evangelical groups, Christian Coalition, Focus on the Family, now Ralph Reed's Faith and Freedom Coalition. But yet, so there has been organization there. There have been feet on the ground there. And, of course, these organizations had a significant percentage of Catholics in them. The only time we had a really good Catholic outreach is when Karl Rove and Governor Bush backed me in doing it during their two presidential elections. But it seems like Catholics are the ones who really need to hear what you're saying.
Well, the Catholic Church is the biggest target on the block, in part because it's organized like a government. with jurisdictional boundaries for parishes, with people who were in charge of certain territorial areas. So it kind of resembles a government. The Protestants or the Baptists don't have the same kind of structure that Catholics do. And the Catholics really are looked at as the ones to go after or to undermine, if only because it's the biggest church, whether or not they believe, you know, that Peter's actually the descendant of, the current Pope is the descendant of Peter and everything. That's kind of on the side. But I'll tell you one thing, that I experienced this back in 1973 when I was working at the Office of Economic Opportunity within the Executive Office of the President. We were transferring programs, these birth control programs, from OEO to Health, Education, and Welfare. And I was the representative of the director of the agency to listen to these bureaucrats talk about transferring him. And there was a Dr. Hellman who was funded by the Rockefeller people, just total screaming liberal for abortion, birth control for everybody, unmarried, doesn't matter. And he had these regional directors from these various parts of the United States. It was divided into 10 jurisdictions, administrative districts. He asked each one of them, in your area, what is the Catholic bishop doing to this program, to this birth control program that OEO was administering? I thought to myself, at least I thought initially, this is an odd question. But then I realized when I heard the responses from the administrators, and then Hellman's response, this guy was named Lewis Hellman, OBGYN, his response back to them, where the Catholic bishops offered resistance, the secular birth control promoters, which were linked to the abortionist, backed off. Where they didn't offer resistance, they just pushed forward. So whether the bishops realize this or not, they're looked at as the kind of a stalking horse for opposition to the secular world.
And like you say, the one reason evangelicals were able to get organized, stay organized, and kind of can refresh themselves is they can just go from megachurch to megachurch and get one guy to agree to do it. That's the pastor. And they're off and running with another, 30,000 potential voters.
Correct.
You just don't do that among Catholics, and I'm not saying you should. I'm not saying that's a good idea. But there's an obvious advantage there.
Well, the Catholics better pay attention. About a month ago, well, this affected the evangelicals as well. In Philadelphia, the so-called Catholic mayor up there decided that the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, which had a contract with the city for placing foster care kids with foster parents who were married, and Bethany Christian Services, which is a non-Catholic group that does the same thing, the mayor rescinded the contract because he was aghast that neither the Archdiocese of Philadelphia nor Bethany Christian Services had the tolerance, the love in their heart to place children with so-called homosexual married couples. They were only dealing with real married couples. So he yanked the contracts. So what that means is, if you abide by the teachings of Moses and Christ and the views of Mother Teresa, John Paul II, or even Obama before he was enlightened in 2012,
You are a
bigot that doesn't deserve to get 1 cent of public money for doing a public service to put a child in a home with as good example that the child will see, as opposed to two guys or two women being considered a married couple. Now, Christ and Moses are on the outs. They are on the bigot list. If it is going on, and it has been going on around the United States, Christians of all stripes better pay attention, because the persecution is just starting now, and it's going to get worse. Let me give you a specific example. You've got civil rights statutes all around the United States, both at the federal level and at the state level. Congress has never identified sexual orientation or gender identity as a protected class, but they have done it to race, to religion, and to sex. If the gender identity or sexual orientation provisions are added to these human rights statutes or civil rights statutes. What that means is the current law right now says to a bank, you can loan to anybody, an individual couple buying a house or an institution building a dormitory, but you can't loan if the institution has racial distinctions or you know, other prohibitions in the civil rights laws. Once the sexual orientation and gender identity get added to the civil rights laws, it will be illegal for a bank, or it can be actionable by a prosecutor or an administrator for a governor in some state, to tell the bank, you will not loan to this Catholic college. Why? Because they practice discrimination. They won't have same-sex married couples in dormitories like they will have man-woman married couples. So you're not going to get a loan. Or if Protestants want to build a parsonage, they will not get the money if the denomination doesn't accept same-sex marriage and its implications. So what I'm saying is our opponents, primarily the LGBT people, want to put Christians in the same legal status that happened to Christians in China after Mao took over, in Russia, in the Soviet Union, after after Stalin became the boss, in Germany after Hitler was there against the evangelicals and the Catholics, or in Mexico under Plutarco Calles, or in all the Eastern European countries after Yalta. You were a non-person. You could not be a lawyer. And in other words, you couldn't get a law license if you were a practicing Christian. If you sent your child to a Christian school, you couldn't be a teacher in a public school. So this is what is going on right now. And the fact that so many American corporations were behind this drive for so-called same-sex marriage, and what they wanted to do was completely bizarre. They wanted the Supreme Court to unilaterally declare that any constitutional amendment at the state level or state law had to be wiped away because the homosexuals had to get what they wanted. So, and the Supreme Court agreed, basically nullifying the votes of 51 million Americans who voted over several years for either constitutional amendments saying marriage is only a relation between one man and one woman, or referenda which affirmed the same circumstance. They don't care. They've got the money. They've got the power. So the Christians had better pay attention, because we're being put in smaller and smaller boxes, and our latitude for action without reprisal is getting more narrow. So you've got to do this now, not 2 years from now.
I'm talking with Bob Marshall, for 26 years, an elected member of the Virginia House of Delegates, pro-lifer. His new book from TAM is entitled Reclaiming the Republic, which is an A to Z civics lesson for Christians and conservatives. In fact, one of the chapters in your book is really one of the best chapters from my point of view, is your chapter on the Supreme Court and the way in which the Supreme Court is operating way beyond its constitutional boundaries. Could you talk a little about that?
They have, now that wasn't the main thrust of my book, but it certainly was.
But it got my interest because it had information I didn't know.
Well, no, you're right. Again,
yeah.
The court has been acting as a super legislature. And there's a lot of assumptions, not just among the public or college professors, but as well as members of Congress, because I've talked to them about this. For example, people think that a Supreme Court decision can only be reversed by legislatively by a constitutional amendment. But there have only been four constitutional amendments that have been reversed. I'm sorry, four Supreme Court decisions that have been reversed by constitutional amendment. The 11th Amendment on who can bring suit against the state. The 14th Amendment on the citizenship of African Americans. The 16th Amendment dealing with the income tax. And the 26th Amendment dealing with people under 21 voting in state elections. Four in 230-some years. Well, that's a very poor record, but yet we're told, oh, if you want to overcome abortion or the same-sex marriage, you have to pass a constitutional amendment. Wait a minute. The abortionists didn't do that. The homosexuals didn't do that. They went through the courts, and the courts, the Supreme Court, is like a weather vane in a lightning storm or tornado. They have reversed themselves from when they first started taking cases in the late 1700s through the summer of 2014. They've reversed themselves 233 times. That doesn't sound like a constitution.
Yeah, your story of Justice Black was chilling.
Oh.
Chilling, and a great example of what you call bigotry from the bench.
He is one of the worst possible justices you could have. The background on him is really disturbing, that he could get nominated to the court. It was done by Franklin Roosevelt. In 1921, there was a Catholic priest in Alabama who was murdered by a pastor whose daughter married a gentleman from Puerto Rico. The wedding was presided over by this priest, and the pastor engaged in such disciplinary activities as locking his daughter in his house, shutting the room, not letting her out, just engaging in all kind of coercive activities against the daughter. Anyway, it didn't work because she got married to this gentleman. He went over, and he asked the priest, did you do this? And he said, well, yes, I presided at the wedding. Well, he shot the guy right there. The trial came up. Black was called, he was an attorney, to defend the accused. And this was involved with the Klan. This guy was a member of the Klan. It turns out that during the trial, Black made sure that the lights were turned down low to emphasize the darkness of the skin of the guy who was married here, and alluding to the fact that he may have black ancestry or something like that. I mean, all the worst racial assumptions you could possibly think of were thrown in this trial. And, of course, he was let off. Black then joined the Ku Klux Klan in 1923 and became an organizer with them. In 1926, he ran for U.S. Senate and won, and he visited most of the KKK, Claverns, or whatever they called them, before the election. So this guy comes in to the U.S. Senate and then to the U.S. Supreme Court with this badge of infamy attached to him with respect to Catholics. He then is the one who comes up and manufactures this decision, saying there's a great wall of separation between church and state, and Jefferson put it there, and if Jefferson were alive to say, who are you talking about? Because Jefferson didn't erect a wall. He only talked about a difference between the federal government and religion, but not totally in general. I'm going to give you an example of this. Excuse me.
People forget how much the KKK was anti-Catholic.
Oh, totally. Jefferson endorsed a treaty between the United States and the Kaskaskia Indians, who were from Indiana and part of Illinois. This was 1803. Part of the treaty, now this is, the guy who supposedly has this strict wall of separation between church and state, which words don't appear anywhere in the Constitution, but that's another point. Anyway, Jefferson approves the treaty, which has the following provisions. Number one, the tribe was converted to Catholicism, I think, by French Jesuits prior to that, but they were deeply Catholic. He approved paying a Catholic priest $100 a year, it's 1803, mind you, to perform his duties as a Catholic priest and to educate in literature the Indians. He then also approved a $300 for construction of a Roman Catholic church on the Indian territory. Does this sound like the guy who's separating church and state like Black wants to? No way. So you've got all kinds of things. And then you had the Northwest Ordinance. The Northwest Ordinance was a provision that first passed in Congress under the Articles of Confederation before the current Constitution was adopted. In there, it applied to the territory, which eventually became five states. There were provisions for how when those territories were being formed, how they could come in to states as part of the United States. Part of the statement in the Northwest Ordinance, which was reenacted in Congress, the first Congress, on the same day that they were taking up the First Amendment, freedom of religion and exercise, it said religion, knowledge, and morality being necessary, to good government, this shall forever be proclaimed in educational matters. So Jefferson was simply following that presumption of the Northwest Ordinance, which was passed under the Articles of Confederation Congress, passed in the first Congress for having some support of religion in general. It wasn't until about 1897 that support for tax money from the federal government for sectarian enterprises was stopped. And there were even land grants prior to that through the 1840s to churches. So where's this separation of church and state that comes in that basically kicks religion out the door?
It was anti-Catholic, from its very core.
Oh, no doubt. I don't even think you could.
And by the way, I want to tell our listeners that the first, say, a quarter to a third of your book is a wonderful overview with great detail in the right places of issues from the founding and regarding religious liberty and the relationship of church and state. And we're gonna go to a short break with Bob Marshall. When we come back, we're gonna talk about what he calls the playbook, terms, strategies, and tactics that Christians need to wake up and get busy applying to their voting and to their political participation. We'll be back with Bob Marshall after this brief message.
Tickets are on sale for FaithFest 2018, coming June 23rd to the St. Francis Retreat Center in DeWitt. Featuring Worship and Praise from Outspoken, Sanctus Real, Jason Gray, J.J. Heller, Brothers Walker, and starring Matt Maher. This family festival of faith will also include vigil worship with Bishop Earl Boyer and fireworks at dusk. For tickets, go to faithfest.com. That's faithfest.com. It's the outdoor Catholic music event of the summer.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, God himself took on flesh and submitted himself to his own laws. What other response can we have except that of Elder Simeon? Now you may dismiss your servant, O Lord.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Ever wonder why we are all fascinated with mystery? Perhaps it is because our Creator God is mystery. From his amazing birth of a virgin to his equally amazing death and resurrection, God's entire existence on earth in Jesus Christ is mystery. The Catholic Catechism tells us that in Christ the whole fullness of deity dwelt bodily. What was visible in his earthly life, says the Catechism, leads to the invisible mystery of his divine sonship and redemptive mission. Christ's earthly journey also serves as a revelation of the Father. He who has seen me has seen the Father, Jesus said. He became man to do his Father's will. Thus, even the smallest characteristics of his mysteries manifest God's love among us. The Lord's whole life is a mystery of redemption. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
You're listening to Ave Maria Radio.
Ave Maria Radio.
I am back with Bob Marshall, who I'll call Delegate Marshall, who was an elected member of the Virginia House of Delegates for 26 years until he got run over by a truck of LGBTQ money and activists, Planned Parenthood volunteers, came from out of state not only to defeat him, but 14 other GOP delegates. He's written this book in order to push hard and educate Christian voters to be politically active and to understand what goes on the inside, how politics really works, how bills get passed, what appropriation bills are, how the courts can be controlled and do what they're constitutionally called upon to do. But let's begin with, Bob, you're describing, what is the role of natural law in all of this?
Deal, it is absolutely fundamental. Why do I say that? Not because it's my own view, but because it was stated in the Declaration of Independence. The laws of nature and nature's God were the standard to which the founders appealed to the world to justify why we were breaking with England and engaging in a war. Now, that's as powerful as you can get. And today, a lot of people think natural law is, well, some Catholic preoccupation. No, it wasn't. There was only one Catholic who signed the Declaration. It was Charles Carroll right. In Carrollton, Maryland. So you had the Protestants, the Congregationalists, Unitarians. Everybody had natural law as the background. So with that as the background, that's the starting point. And I show how this is congruent with the teachings of natural law as best explained by several of the popes. So if you start there, you're going from the foundation that the founders did. So that's the best place to proceed. And
well, mean, it's the Catholic advantage over, you know, even Protestants, who most of whom have rejected natural law as being in fundamental sync with revelation and the law, you know, laws of God. So this makes it possible for us to work side by side, even with people who have no faith.
That's correct. I mean, St. Paul says, you know, that some of these pagans or non-Christians do by nature what the Christians are supposed to do by revelation. But that being the case, you start there and you proceed. How do you go and do this? The rights are there to be protected by government, not the other way around. So that's why you create government in the first place, to protect rights, not to fabricate them or make them up. You then have the structure that you have to deal with and the passage of laws. I outline in the book steps in legislation, and I also outline for you how to run a precinct. A precinct is the smallest cell in the body politic. There's about 187,000 precincts in the United States. What that means is the entire land territory of the United States is divided up into these 187,000 precincts, which is the geographic boundary line for where people live and where they go to vote. The size of a precinct is not determined by geography. It isn't even determined by absolute population of the number of people living there. It's determined by the number of people that it would take to get through the voting process in whatever period the state laws allow for voting. So if you've got some of 12 hours, some of 13, the size of the precinct, again, is the number of voters that can reasonably get through a voting process. So that's the first step that's taken. But to go back to the legislation, everything in Congress starts in a committee, just like an unborn child. The child starts small and then grows bigger. Most of what happens to a bill will happen in a committee in how it's formed and how it's shaped. But that doesn't have to be the end of things. In fact, if you have a member of state legislature or Congress, tells you that, well, look, the bill that you liked was killed in committee, and that's the end of it. That's not the end of it, because every legislative body, and I looked at the rules of all the states at one point, and Congress, I'm very familiar with those, has a method for getting a bill out of a committee, even if a committee is hostile to what you want to do. It's called a discharge petition, in which members sign a statement given to, or held in the confidence of the chief administrative officer of the body, the clerk of the House of Delegates or State Assembly or the State Senate. And then if the majority sign it, the bill is kicked out of the floor for consideration. Or someone gets up on the floor and makes a motion, Mr. Speaker, I move that House Bill 123, a measure for requiring parental consent for abortion, be moved out of the courts committee. And then you vote on it. So whatever roadblock people can run into, and I've seen them being put out there, I've given you ways around them. And voting, how does voting take place? There's three ways in which voting takes place. One is called a voice viva voca, Latin for by voice. That means the people in favor of a position say yes, the people opposed say no. But that only, then the presiding officer or the chairman says, well, the ayes have it or the nays have it. If you want to know how many people voted for and against it, you don't know it. So the other kind of voting is called a division vote, where people raise their hands, they're counted, and for it and against it. What you know is the total number of people who were voted for the bill, voted against the bill, and those who didn't vote at all. But that still doesn't tell you who voted. The only way to know that, and in the book of John, it talks about evil loving the darkness, so that's why record votes are so important. And the Constitution was structured to get record votes, so you could have accountability by those who represent us to the citizens, is a record vote. And so there's a rule that if one-fifth of the members of any body ask for a record vote, you get a record vote. Now, you may not win the vote, but you at least find out how people stand. And that's
right.
The first step to getting somebody elected or unelected. Let me give you an example of how I use this. In 1976, a friend of mine gave me a Freedom of Information request that he got from Health, Education, and Welfare, in which he found out that about 280,000 children had been killed over the time period he requested with tax money by abortion. In the same programs as opposed to so-called prevent the so-called need for abortion. I thought this was outrageous on a couple grounds. First, the killing. Second, using tax money. So I went, took this FOIA document, went down to Congress and pulled a friend of mine off the floor who was in Congress. He was from Southern Maryland. He and I were in a group called Young Americans for Freedom when we were in high school. I pulled him off the floor and gave him the FOIA and said, look, can you get somebody to offer an amendment to the labor and health, education, and welfare bill. This is one of the tactics, going after the money. I said, because the Democrats have been tying us up for 3 years, from 1973 to 1976. And he looked at this, and I gave him some language. He said, there's a freshman here who might be interested. Turns out it was Henry Hyde. So he gave it to Henry Hyde. But 5 weeks later, Henry puts the amendment on the HCW bill that became the Hyde Amendment. That's still law. So that just happened by me going down there, one congressman giving it to Henry Hyde, Henry Hyde offering it. Now, at that time, they just had life of the mother. I don't like any exception, but that's what we've done, because most of the statutes were that way. Then rape and incest, which are really atrocious, immoral, but they're there. But they still restrict abortion. For the just abortion on demand. So that is still the law. That was a step that you can take at the state level to get your legislators to not give any money to groups that don't want to pay, that want to pay for abortion, but you want to put everybody on the spot. The reason you want to put people on the spot is you want to know who to support and who to oppose in the next election. And you've got to get hard votes. In other words, ones that you may not win, but you want to know who's going to stick with you in the clutch. If someone's going to bail out of a foxhole, I don't want that person with me going on the beach to go on after the enemy. I want people who will stay with me through thick and thin. And the reasoning I had, to back up for a second, on the money is this. Congress cannot afford to lose the power of the purse, at least formally. I mean, they're prodigal spenders, but they've got to be the ones who play Santa Claus, not the courts. Nobody else can do that. If they lose it, it's a problem. And I'll tell you how I came to know this in just practicality. I worked for a while for Congressman Bob Dornan, and he from Southern California.
Great
man. He's the one who, great guy, still around. he put me down in the basement of one of the buildings. I mean, he wasn't tying me up or gagging me. He wanted me to read the precedents of the House of Representatives, the rules. So I did this, and I used to give him these rules like policy grenades, and he would lob them and tie Tip O'Neill up in knots all over the place because of the rules. You know the process. You can determine the outcome. Anyway, we were in a conference, and I was assisting Congressman Dornan. A conference committee is a meeting between designees, members of the House of Representatives, and the Senate, just a few from each side, to work out the differences in various versions of legislation to deal with the same topic. One of the members of the House came up to Bob Dornan and said, look, you guys, you and I differ on the abortion question. And it was correct that this guy was a Catholic, and he was a war hero, so nothing, you know, phony about the guy. He just was on the wrong side of this issue. But he said to Dornan, he said, if we had lost the Hyde Amendment in court, this is when the Hyde Amendment was attacked by Planned Parenthood, he said, I would have put in court stripping bills faster than you would have. So I thought to myself, bingo, this guy, even though he voted against the Hyde Amendment, knew that the formal authority to appropriate the money has got to remain in Congress. So that is a tactic that is very powerful. And putting limitations on spending has occurred with, you know, no money to overthrow the communist and the Angola government, no money for certain actions in South America. And where did I get the idea? James Madison. He said the budget, use of the public purse, is the most effectual and immediate way to control public policy. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but I put his actual words in the book. And it is. Because if there's no money for anything, you can't do it. So if the Congress would all of a sudden say, we're not giving any money to the Justice Department to implement orders against state colleges that don't have provisions for same-sex dormitories, the state could do it, but they wouldn't be getting any federal money. And cut off of federal money is such a powerful incentive or disincentive to do or not to do things that it's almost dispositive of what you want to do. So the power of the purse, whether working it in Congress or working it in your state legislature or even with a city or county council, it's a way to get a quick record vote. And again, it's a way to get a vote that are otherwise made impossible because the bills are killed in committee. So that's the importance of using this amendment process to get people on record.
What about this? You have an entire section on understanding appropriations and how, if you understand them, how they can be used to set policy back on the right track.
That is absolutely correct. And the appropriations bills must go through, with the exception of Nebraska, which is a unitary or a unibody legislature. That means there's only one house. Every other legislature in the United States, if it's a state legislature, there are two houses, a state house and a state senate, or state assembly or state delegates and a state senate. And then the U.S. Congress has that. So each side has to deal with many bills, and they deal with them in different ways. So if you cannot get your vote on one side, you try to get it on the other side. And again, the best way to do it, the most efficacious way to do it, is to put the other side on the defensive and try to get your member to amend a bill in committee. Because then it makes the other side have to go on record, say, well, we would rather shut the entire federal government down and give no money to the military so we can give money to Planned Parenthood. It kind of reverses the rhetoric that you have to get things done. So I put in there suggestions for amendments dealing with marriage, ways to slow that up, and ways to curb the abortion influence. So those are the, in other words, I don't necessarily want to go to all the details right now, but they're in the book, and they're spelled out, and I had excellent parliamentarians assist me where I didn't know some of these things for the Senate. So, but this right here is the way to proceed.
You also want to strongly make the point that pro-lifers don't need to be working toward a constitutional amendment.
Deal, that's absolutely correct. It's like we've been sent down a rabbit hole or, you know, told to go climb Mount Everest when, you know, climbing a, you know, a small 30-foot hill might have done the same thing. And, again, the abortionists didn't try to get a constitutional amendment legalizing abortion. They went through the courts. As a matter of fact, if you know the history of the so-called abortion reform movement, about 1965 to 72, they added these exceptions for fetal disability, rape, and incest to the abortion laws. And they were pitching the emotional angle right here. But around 1972, the Right to Life forces had gotten organized, and they were starting to reverse this, especially even in New York State, where they were going to reverse the liberalized bill that was passed under Nelson Rockefeller. When the Supreme Court stepped in, well, they didn't have to go state by state. So, you know, we need to be mindful that the Supreme Court is not the entire ballgame here. And reversing them is not simply the result of a constitutional amendment. You can do it with the money. I give you a specific example. You may not know it, but the Supreme Court just Chief Justice goes from the building across the mall, the top of the hill there, over to the Appropriations Committee in the House and Senate, and he gives a budget what he wants the Congress to give to operate the courts. Excuse me. In the money bill, it's called State Justice, Commerce, and Judiciary. There's four agencies in there. Maybe more now, but that's the basic ones. In that bill, the one I read and I put in the book, there's a restriction that Congress put in there that says you can't spend more than $10,000 on receptions. Well, I mean, that's pretty specific. And if you can put limitations on how much you can spend on receptions or how much money you can spend on rental cars when you go to conferences, you can control everything that's done. So if you have a member of Congress saying you can't do this, say, sorry. I put the examples in my book to counter any one of these weasels who wants to get out of doing things. And the long term is we have to change the jurisdiction of the federal courts. Now, this is yes. not a harebrained idea of Bob Marshall. And I put in the book that Justice Chase in 1799 and Justice Frankfurter in about the 1940s all point out that what kind of cases that the Supreme Court or even any federal court can hear is totally under the control of Congress. And this is not even a question. It's not like I'm denying judicial review where there's a controversy here. And by the way, when this was discussed at the Constitutional Convention, it was rejected that courts should have any role in establishing public policy. The only role that courts are supposed to do is settle litigation between plaintiffs and defendants. It was supposed to settle a case, not to decide a public policy.
Right.
So how far this goes, during the Civil War, during the Civil War, remember, the Dred Scott decision stated that Congress could not outlaw slavery, among other things, that Congress could not outlaw slavery in the territories, and that undid the Missouri Compromise from 1820, which said, above a certain latitude, states coming into the Union will be free states, and below a certain latitude, states will automatically come into the Union as slave states. Supreme Court said, you can't do that. Well, come now 1862, the war is on, the Congress passes, and Lincoln signs the bill. What did this bill do? It said there will be no slavery in the territories. I think it was specifically talking about New Mexico. But here's Congress doing exactly what the Supreme Court said you had no authority to do.
Right.
And the president saying, yeah, I'm signing it. Now, what's the court going to do? Absolutely nothing. So if you got a Congress saying, well, the court has spoken, it's the supreme law of the land, that's not in the Constitution. The supreme law of the land in the civil order is by Congress, not
right.
the court. And in fact, this is something that just really frosts me. Our efforts by the homosexuals to take the constitutional amendments for one man, one woman marriage off the statute books or state laws that do the same. That is a mistake and must be resisted just strongly. Why do I say that? In 1923, there was a challenge to a statute that Congress had passed operating in the District of Columbia that had certain limitations on child labor. A challenge was taken. The Supreme Court struck it down. 13 years later, 1936, another challenge was taken to a statute dealing with child labor. And the Supreme Court reversed itself. Remember I said it reversed itself 233 times? Well, this was one of those times. So Franklin Roosevelt wrote a letter to his attorney general and said, look, do we have to reenact the statute banning child labor in the District of Columbia? And his attorney general said, no. All a court can do is suspend enforcement of a law. They can't remove it from the statute books. Either the legislative body has to do that, or in the case of a constitutional amendment at the state level, the people have to do that. So don't fall for this, oh, it's only symbolic. Sorry, symbols have very profound meanings in what they symbolize. And do not do this. Make the other side work harder over this.
Well, this, you know, this book, and I want to remind our readers again, from Tan, entitled Reclaiming the Republic, is for anyone who wants to know, both from the point of view of principle, but also from the point of view of practicality, what they can do individually to try to reorient our nation from before it goes off the cliff. You talk about moral collapse, and yeah, there is a collapsing going on. The question becomes whether or not that can be arrested at some point. You know, it seems like people have lost all notion of, you know, just the boundaries between what they can do and what they absolutely refuse to do. It seems like that refuse to do doesn't exist a lot in a lot of people.
Well, it is correct. In the book of Hosea, it says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. But it doesn't mean you have to be destroyed for lack of knowledge. If you have knowledge, you can act. Let me give you ways. You know, you don't have to blow up a whole structure to stop the onslaught of an army. You just have to do some small things. For example, people claim, the abortionists claim, abortion is safer than childbirth, which is bizarre. Well, if it's safer than childbirth, then you shouldn't complain if we want some people to collect abortion complication data. Now,
right.
But the difference here is this. For years, the Centers for Disease Control, which I call the Center for Delusion Contrivance at one point, they simply wanted to know the incidence of a complication that the abortionist reports while the abortion is going on. Once the woman's off the operating table, doesn't matter, she could fall dead, you know, on the way out. They didn't want that reported. So in 1988, a friend of mine, who's a professor of public health at George Washington University, and I, this is before I was a delegate, wrote to every OB and GY and emergency room physician in Virginia. And we asked them to tell us, that we're private citizens, did you treat a complication in the following area? And the areas we wanted to know were the ones that the Center for Disease Control wanted to know. So we didn't add anything that was different. We got private individuals 650% greater reporting of incidence complications than was reported to the Center for Disease Control. Why? Because the CDC didn't want to collect
right.
data.
Right.
It's like saying the roads are safe and there's nobody out there, you know, governing traffic. You wouldn't say
now,
that.
Bob, I got to interrupt because I want to get in one more plug for your book before we run out of time.
Okay.
My listeners, you know, I've been talking to Bob Marshall, who was a delegate, the Virginia House of Delegates for 26 years. He's got a great book out called Reclaiming the Republic from Tan. Buy it. Learn how to be politically effective. Bob Marshall, I really appreciate your coming on the show and sharing your not only your experience, but your wisdom.
Well, Neil, thank you for having the insight to see how important this is and
it
how
is.
The tools
it
of your,
crucial.
You know, to protect us. Thank you so much.
And those of you who are there, I'll be back here at this time on this day next week.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.